gave me a chance to pursue something that you know, I've been working on for a long time, but without that much success. By 2001, the collapse of the internet bubble was already complete by the summer of 2001. By the summer of 2002, the new cycle of wars in Central Asia and in the Middle East had already begun. And at the time, there was a lot of talk and a lot of concern about deflation in the world economy, that is to say, a general collapse of prices, which is something that hadn't really been talked about seriously since 1929, really, since the 30s, but which came back as a discussion at a high level among the people who deal with the world monetary system. And I was extremely curious about that and researched it at the time and begun to look for some real explanations of the notion of political economy, that is to say, the link between the two. But in fact, the materials available were not that good. And it's only recently that I've found some theory that comes close to doing justice to this notion of political economy in the current situation. So now that we have the microphone adjusted, I'll go on to my concept itself and present this theoretical material that I've been reading recently and offer some hypotheses, which are basically a research program that I'll be working on in the upcoming year. So, the concept I'm going to present draws directly from the work of Shimshon Bickler and Jonathan Nitzan. It describes the economic phases of depth and breadth and correlates them with the first and second order cybernetics of control. It attempts to situate the functions of cultural communicational labor within these economic phases. It questions those on the autonomous left who thought it would be possible to transform a broadly expansionary phase of capitalism, like that of the 90s, into a qualitatively different society. It's not a polemic, but seeks to open up a field of strategic debate. It doesn't assert a future, but observes the unfolding of the present into the depths of violence, which has robbed resistance movements of their potential again. The concept is peace for war. At stake here is society itself, the really existing forms of social cooperation. The Argentinian activist Ezequiel Abramovsky writes about exactly that, and I quote Abramovsky, "Today, the division of labor is so deep that each minute, even without realizing it, each of us is relying on the labor of millions of people from all over the world." End quote. This lecture, the images, the words, my voice through the microphone or over the internet is literally brought to you by the labors of Asia, the Americas, Africa, and Europe combined. The question is, what guides the dynamics of our worldwide cooperation? How is order maintained? And why does this order periodically descend into chaos, as it's doing right now in the Middle East? Abramovsky points out that nothing encourages even asking such questions, much less answering them. And I quote again, "In the capitalist system, paradoxically enough, the institutions that enable and organize such a high level of social cooperation are the very same that separate us from the other and make us isolated individuals without responsibility in regards to other people. Yes, I am talking about the market and the state. Buying and consuming products and voting for candidates in an election involves no answerability. These are actions performed by isolated individuals." Order will not provide a language to explain its own chaos. The essence of contemporary power is to provoke crisis and to ride it out toward profit without revealing strategies or goals. The effect of such huge unknowns is to make people cling to their identities and their operational routines for fear that the public disruption will spread into their own private lives. What resistance movements are lacking is a common language to describe, predict, and oppose the maneuvers of the most powerful groups in the world. Bickler and Nitzan's work, and particularly their article, Dominant Capital and the New Wars, tries to show exactly why peace is allowed to become war under the contemporary political economic order. Their starting point is the measurement of value. Neither the Marxist concept of abstract labor nor the notion of the utility of a good in classical economics are really able to designate an objective foundation of value, according to them. But what can be observed and measured in capitalist society are prices, profits, and losses. In short, money, the system's internal measurement, the one its leading actors refer to all the time. The fluctuation of prices, profits, and losses is the index of shifts in power relations. In this sense, the economy is always political. It has no external objective touchstone, like abstract labor or like the notion of the utility of a good. What the fluctuations measure, or at least the only thing we can really tell from these fluctuations, are the changing politics of what Bickler and Nitzan call differential accumulation. To speak of capital in the singular is something like the night where all Cadillacs are black, to update Hegel's phrase. If power relations actually give value its measure, then what matters is beating the average. What matters is not just accumulating, but doing better than the average, standing out. The corporations with the highest rates of profit will be able to actually shape the environment in which they operate, either directly with their own resources, or more importantly, through collaboration with the state. Such corporations make the market, as they say in financial circles. They impose technologies, laws, standards, and prices. They are dominant capital. But dominant capital itself is not singular. At the heart of Bickler and Nitzan's analysis are two very different strategies for differential accumulation, associated with two very different political economic cultures. One of these strategies is called breadth, expansiveness, and the other, depth. Think of profit, to conceive what's happening, think of profit as the number of employees times the earnings per employee. How does a corporation beat the average rate? One way is to increase the number of people working. That can be done by building new capacity, so-called greenfield investment. You actually build a factory, a store, or whatever. But too much capacity creates a glut, and a glut destroys a market. So the more common route is to buy away the competition through mergers and acquisitions. Industrial sabotage, destroying the competition, like the politics of the Treuhand, for instance, in unified Germany, is a strategy of breadth. It's about destroying potential competitors to make yourself relatively bigger. It's associated with speculative fever as corporations double or triple in market share overnight. But insofar as real capacity does in fact increase, breadth is also associated with proletarianization or the induction of more people into the global labor force, like the populations of China, Russia, and India in the 1990s. The other strategy, depth, means increasing the amount of earnings per employee. Here again, there are two basic avenues. One is to cut costs, to do more with less, to be lean and mean, which has become the watchword of capitalism. Everybody tries to do it all the time. But the other way is to raise prices, even if that causes inflation, and even if rising prices are accompanied by stagnation of the economy as a whole. So depth, the strategy of depth, is typically accompanied by stagflation, which is anathema from the majority point of view. This is only a strategy that can be practiced by a minority, a small fraction of dominant capital. Only the most powerful corporations can take the first moves in a strategy of depth. And the only way they can legitimately raise their prices, that is, the only way they can succeed in forcing people to pay the higher prices, is to seize the occasion offered by a crisis, which is typically the occasion of a war. Why does a fraction of dominant capital periodically succeed in launching a strategy of depth? What Bickler and Nitzan have done is to show that the major waves of corporate expansion through mergers and acquisitions have all reached their size limits or filled out what could be conceived as their envelopes of possibility. You can see this over the course of a century. As they write, merger booms tend to hype up investors and make market conditions increasingly fragile as the boom progresses. Eventually, negative sentiment sets in, making the market inhospitable for merger until the next reversal in mood. Furthermore, breaking each envelope involves major legal, institutional, and political realignments, and that takes time. The consequence is that the whole process is susceptible to major interruptions. It is here that stagflation enters the picture. A graph that they've assembled shows four great waves of mergers. You can see at the beginning the monopoly phase at the turn of the early opening of the 20th century, the oligopoly phase, which was vertical integration during the 1920s, the first companies that began to control both the processes of industrial production all the way from extraction to distribution. Then a conglomerate period of the very large multi-divisional corporations in the 50s and 60s, where people went beyond the envelope of their particular industry and assembled several industries under a single corporate identity. And finally, the globalization phase of the 1990s, which became possible, you know, after major legal, institutional, economic realignments, essentially the end of the Soviet Union, right? So they go on, Bickler and Nitzan go on, I forgot to explain a little thing. What's being shown here is the buy-to-build ratio. That means that if you buy something, it's different than if you build it. So this line goes up when there's more buying than building going on, when there's more merger and acquisition than greenfield investment. And that's how you can see these merger phases over history. So this line is the buy-to-build ratio. A further graph shows that from the 1940s onward, a period of stagflation inevitably accompanies any drop in the buy-to-build curve. So that thick black line are periods of stagflation. Stagflation is the sign of depth. Since the post-war period, since 1945, the two divergent strategies of dominant capital, breadth and depth, have clearly become two distinct temporal phases in the rhythm of accumulation as a whole. Their curves become exactly symmetrical. Whenever the buy-to-build ratio goes down, whenever mergers and acquisitions slow down, stagflation goes up. Inflation and economic stagnation go up. It really becomes exactly symmetrical after 1945, which means somehow that a pattern is recognized and mastered. It no longer has anything to do with an accident. But the question becomes, who are the actors of these two different phases? And what are the relations between those groups of actors? Bickler and Nitzan don't have a lot to say about the high-tech companies and financial actors, or what they call the techno-dollar, merger-dollar alliance that dominated the speculative fevers of the 90s. What interests them instead is integrated oil and defense, the petrodollar weapon dollar coalition. A graph shows how its share of global net corporate profit grew tremendously during the stagflation period of the 1970s as the Middle East replaced Southeast Asia as the focus of the global arms market, and as the OPEC embargoes helped Western oil majors extort record prices at the pump, like they're doing now. What's at stake, they're saying, in the Middle Eastern wars is neither the rarity of oil resources, nor the scramble to control them, nor even the cost of obtaining them. What's at stake for the corporations, for the weapon dollar, petrodollar coalition, is the capacity of those corporations to raise prices against a backdrop of crisis and uncertainty. The implication is that a low point, like the one you see around the end of the 1990s, at a low point, and particularly after a long period of decline, the crises themselves could be encouraged, or maybe even ignited, as the only surefire path to the recovery of differential profits. The petrocore, the petroleum-producing core, according to Bickler and Nitzan, is composed of six Anglo-American companies, which actually merged into four major companies during the 1990s. BP, Amoco, ExxonMobil, Royal Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, and Texaco. A bar graph, and this is probably the most interesting thing that Bickler and Nitzan have come up with, a bar graph shows that since the mid-1960s, every time the petrocore's rate of return slips below that of the Fortune 500 companies on the average, that is, every time their differential accumulation becomes lower than that of dominant capital as a whole, the average Fortune 500 return, every time that happens, a conflict in the Middle East will follow. Do you remember these conflicts? The Arab-Israeli War in 67, then another in 73, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the first Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 78-79, the beginning of the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in 80, and the second invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the first Gulf War of 1990-91, the Palestinian Intifada of 2000, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, and finally, the Iraq invasion of 2003. Of course, the petrocore does not cause these wars. But from 1973 onward, each one of these wars is accompanied by a significant or even spectacular rise in the oil majors' rate of differential profit. So what type of causality are we talking about here? There's a difference between this kind of argumentation and the conspiracy theories that have sprung up concerning, for instance, the real events of September 11. Consider the do-it-yourself documentary Loose Change, which is actually quite an interesting thing to watch, which you can easily Google that, and you'll find it on Google Video, in fact. Which claims, among other things, that a Boeing 757 did not hit the Pentagon, and that the 16-foot diameter hole in the wall of the Pentagon would have more likely been caused by a cruise missile, a Tomahawk fired from an A3 jet, both manufactured by the Raytheon Corporation. Now, there's a conspiracy theory for you, right? This is the classic sort of paranoid American conspiracy theory. Dylan Avery, who is the maker of this film, is 22 years old. He came of age at the turning point of Peace for War. Raytheon, the corporation, is almost 100 years old. It forms part of what Bickler and Nitzan call the Armacorps, or the Seven Archangels of Armageddon, which also includes Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, the British manufacturer BAE Systems, and the Euro Consortium EADS. These companies have a century of experience in the politics of depth. Bickler and Nitzan say nothing about the 16-foot hole in the wall of the Pentagon. This doesn't interest them, or it doesn't figure into their work. They focus instead on the threat to the Western economies, not just of stagnation, but of outright deflation, a threat which arose with the collapse of the new economy bubble. They analyze the Financial Times article of April 2003, which called on Alan Greenspan to go for more inflation. They quote, that's completely, and you know, you don't do that according to neoliberal economics, right? But in 2003, major financial actors published this article calling on Greenspan to actually push inflation in the U.S. and therefore in the world economy. They also quote a famous declaration from the Project for a New American Century on Rebuilding America's Defenses, written in the year 2000, which claims that the process of transforming the U.S. defense budget, that is a way also, as we're going to see, to push inflation, is likely to be a long one, they say, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. And finally, they produce yet another graph showing the decline of U.S. defense spending since World War II, from 15% of GDP during the Korean War to 10% for Vietnam, 7.5% for Reagan's incredible Star Wars program, right, which was sort of a way to carry on military defense spending in the absence of an outright war, and then finally a mere 3.8% under Clinton, which again has to be taken as a real danger signal for the arms industry. So here you're not being presented with a conspiracy theory. You're being presented with statistical outlines behind which you can see the changing fortunes of certain groups, their possible motivations, and the consequences for them of international events. You're being asked to decide whether a fraction of American capital, closely allied with elements of the state and historically accustomed to exerting a preponderant influence over the forms and dynamics of social cooperation, would have any interest in seizing on the events of September 11 as an excuse to re-engineer the entire pattern of capital accumulation that had been established during the merger boom of the 1990s. You're being asked, in effect, whether there are voluntary operators, governors, steersmen of peace for war. At this point, I think very few of us are likely to say no to this hypothesis. So the more interesting question becomes, where are we in all this? Should we take the side, therefore, of the so-called technodollar, merger dollar coalition? Should we rather go with Bill Gates and George Soros and all the people who dominated the political economy of the 1990s, the World Trade Organization and so on? Would it really be possible to do away with the old economy, as some people, some autonomous Marxists, believe, in favor of a new economy? Does the decline of the arms industry represent a historical chance, a could have been, that might still be, with the help of another democratic or social democratic government? These questions, I think, in turn, call for others. Why did the post-September 11 political economic hijacking by the party of war, oil, and engineering meet with such ineffective resistance from the other fractions of dominant capital? Was it, as Bickler and Nitzan suggest, that their prospects for further accumulation were simply exhausted by virtue of their very success in the preceding decades? Was fear of deflation enough to make them pass the baton? Did all of dominant capital simply acquiesce in the repetition of a pattern that had characterized capital accumulation throughout the 20th century? Or would it be possible, for instance, where the European Union and its separate nations are concerned, to map out which corporations and which key officials came down on which sides of which dividing lines. Would it be possible to map out the different power configurations within the overall political economy of the world right now? And would it be possible to do that for each of our European countries and for the European Union as a whole? That's the question that I'm asking. And I think that the answer to that question right now is no, because basically no one has done this kind of work. No one has tried to take into account these two major phases in capital accumulation and see which individuals and which corporations come down on which sides, so as to set about practically trying to influence the course of events that would really lead to a historical disappearance of the arms industry from the scene. This kind of work has not been done. We don't even have, as I was saying before, the common language to talk about what's really happening in the field of political economy. But isn't this kind of mapping what we would need to resist the strategies of the major actors who create the worlds that we live in? In their most comprehensive work, which is called The Global Political Economy of Israel, Bickler and Nitzan have traced the transformation of the contemporary Israeli ruling class within the context of the Middle Eastern energy conflicts and of their particular role in the political economy of the world as a whole. This kind of work can show who gains and in which ways from the transformation of the peace dividend back into war profits. One of the weaknesses of the international resistance movements has been an inability to chart out the oscillations of peace for war. Yet, without this capacity, there is no common language. Each generation's experience becomes incomprehensible to the next as the curves reverse and the pendulum of accumulation keeps on violently swinging. Capital accumulation, as we've seen throughout all the above, is inseparable from politics. It's what Guattari called the integral of power formations. That means it also produces subjectivity, and it does so differentially, in diverging phases, as I've tried to make clear. Resistant culture, the kind that can cross the generations, has to be able to escape these oscillating phases, to steer outside the political subjectivity of peace for war. I want to close now with some open questions about contemporary governance and about governmentality, that is to say, the rationalities whereby we shape our own behavior. For this, let's return to our departure point, the remarks of Ezekiel Abramovsky. We live in an age of unprecedented cooperation, but also of unprecedented conflict between isolated individuals mediated mostly by computers. My first idea, my first hypothesis for research is that we should see the governmental science of this separated and interconnected age, literally its form of steersmanship, as being cybernetics, the science of cybernetics that began to develop immediately after the end of the Second World War, in fact, during the Second World War. Cybernetics has developed historically in two modes, and perhaps in two distinct phases. First-order cybernetics corresponds to the formula of purpose controlled by feedback, as described in the early text of Norbert Wiener. The phrase refers to the logical structure of efforts undertaken by organisms and machines to transform the environment in which they evolve by gradually altering or correcting their own activity on the basis of information gathered in the course of the transformative action itself. The stimulus to automate this kind of activity was given by nothing other than war, the need to automate artillery in order to respond to the exceptionally fast and mobile action of enemy planes. In fact, cybernetics basically comes from electrical engineering for servo motors. This is the origin of all the Wiener's work and all the people, Shannon, also all the people who were working on it at that time. It was a matter, in other words, of targeting and eliminating problems by setting up circular flows of self-correcting information. This kind of feedback is negative. It does not seek to add energy to the system, but merely to correct the errors on its way to purpose. The entire revolution in military affairs, or closer to us, the current frenzy over biometrics and biometrical control of movement, bears witness to this way of thinking, what might be called government by self-preservation. More broadly, the entire logistical system of globalized industry and distribution, and then of just-in-time production, is based on this kind of first-order cybernetics. My second hypothesis, therefore, is that as a governmental science, first-order cybernetics corresponds to an economic phase of depth and to situations of violent conflict, where the priority is to look out for number one. This is clearly true to the extent that it emerged from World War II. However, the most interesting question, once again, concerns the phases of breadth and the varieties of so-called second-order cybernetics. Take, for starters, something which is not talked about very much, but is a kind of basic and very widely utilized form of second-order cybernetics, namely the system dynamics of a guy named J. Wright Forrester, which were exposed in volumes of continually expanding scope. He starts with industrial dynamics, he then goes on to urban dynamics, and finally to world dynamics. His innovation is to study the feedback loops that come into play between distinct systems, each of which are already dynamic and feedback-based in their own right. So he begins to study the inner relations of looped systems, the way that loops grow between loops, so that you have dynamic systems that can expand, where you can model a very large system. And I think it's very clear that in a phase of mergers and acquisitions, and particularly in the globalizing phase, it becomes very important to be able to model the dynamics of interconnected systems. Otherwise, it's not possible to actually control the development and the spread of a corporation's activity, or when it comes to the state, a state which wants to encourage a number of corporations' activity over the world space. You need to have a modeling system to do that. And the basic modeling system for that is, in fact, system dynamics, as developed by Forrester and his followers. Forrester, who did his pioneering theoretical work in the 1950s and 60s, was perfectly in tune with the phase of conglomerate capital, when corporations expanded outside their original industries. He integrates into his conceptions positive feedback, which can be seen as the cybernetic equivalent of growth. But despite the continuing use of his studies by industry, there's probably nothing in Forrester that can interest us philosophically today. As you might guess from the failure of his project on world dynamics and of the famous Limits to Growth report that it inspired in 1972. This is the report that predicted that the world system would not be able to handle sustained capitalist growth into beyond the 21st century. But this report has not done any help really to anyone besides to shock people. The problem is that Forrester's models can predict only the growth, and they never succeed in staging an encounter with the limits. Consider where positive feedback led in the 1990s. In 1994, the economist Brian Arthur, linked to the Santa Fe Institute for Complexity Studies, wrote a book entitled Increasing Returns and Path Dependence in the Economy, in which he showed how positive feedback into a network can lead to exponential growth and can also allow people to conquer monopoly positions as they install themselves first in a situation, and then all the rest of the path of that industry will be dependent on what they've done. This turned out to be the key theoretical text of the new economy. The third hypothesis, which I would like to explore, is whether the expansion of a system through the circular reiteration of its own potentials, can be correlated with the heavily financialized kind of breadth economy that was developed in the 1990s, when dominant capital, in collaboration with the informatics industries, invented whole new semiotic realms for the valorization of its increasingly symbolic wealth. Could the political economic agitations of the turn of the century, including all the protest movements and transnational social movements of which many of us were a part, have been an inevitable culmination of this semiotic expansion? If this were true, then the speculative crack, the speculative collapse of the years 2000-2001 would appear as a classic case of uncontrollable oscillation, exactly as Norbert Wiener describes it in the early work on electrical servo mechanisms, where he speaks of a hunting pattern that spirals out of control in a targeting machine whose internal gyrations are constantly causing it to overshoot its own marks, worsening the situation with each new attempt at correction. This would seem to be exactly the destiny of the long breadth phase that came to its culmination at the turn of the century. The heart of what I want to say is here. The present disaster is its own condemnation, even if we have yet to sufficiently map all the interests that combine to make it endure. But beyond that, perhaps 5 or 10 years into the future, lies the possibility of a new phase of breadth, which, if it comes, will be intensive this time, expanding not only geographically, but now into the micro dimensions of bio and nanotechnologies, as a new envelope beyond the limits of the global. Such a phase would have tremendous subjectifying power. It seems to me that as cultural activists, we have to consider the relative failure of the attempts to overflow the preceding breadth phase by introducing more or less arbitrary information and behavior into the system. This is something that many people thought could be possible, to kind of cause the system to overflow itself, to spin out of control as it clearly reached levels of complexity which could no longer be sustained despite all the models of positive feedback that had been developed and despite the profitability that those models had shown throughout the 1990s. So there was a lot of agitation at the turn of the century, and the question I'm asking was the strategy of trying to contribute to that agitation in the hopes of overflowing the limits of the traditional patterns of capitalism, was that strategy not a relative failure? And should we not draw the real consequences from that failure? I think this is a very important question. It seems to me that a system that expands by absorption through fusion and acquisition with the delirious ambition of integrating all obstacles into an infinite multiplication and diversification of the same basic principles seems fated at the limit point to reverse into its mirror opposite, which is a targeting system that works, something like government by destruction. The lack of an ability to map out the gyrations of the same and to encounter at their limit the irresolvable equation of the other is what seems to keep us inside the concept of peace for war.